I was born in 1965 in a place called Rathcoole, which is the largest working class loyalist Protestant housing estate in the world.
Belfast-born playwright Gary Mitchell is proud of his Protestant heritage. His childhood in Rathcoole was both ordinary and extraordinary.
When I was 9 years old, 1974, I wanted to go to a place called Rathfurin, which is literally one road away. So I went to the edge of Rathcoole and had to cross this road. And there was barricades all over the road. And there were men walking up and down with guns. I was approached by a man who basically told me where to go. And I didn't want to go there. And I said, I'm calling for my friend and I have to get across the road. And the man basically said, are you nuts? There's Teagues out there. And I didn't know what a Teague was. I was 9 and he told me what it meant. Teagues would rape me, kill me, cut me up, you know, and my friend if I managed to get to him. I went home that day. I had nightmares that night. And I asked my mum and dad, I said, you know, are there really Teagues out there trying to kill us? And, you know, my mum and dad said, catch yourself on, wise up. But then you see you had two realities. You had the reality of your house where your mum and dad told you certain truths. Then you had the reality of the playground where most kids believe they learn the truth, the facts of life.
In his teenage years, Mitchell learned more of the facts of life on the football fields of North Belfast.
I was in the B team in soccer in school and I couldn't get a game except that every year we had to play a Catholic football team. A lot of boys phoned in sick that day and they didn't want to go to a Catholic school to play a Catholic football team. Now, the first time this happened to me, the school teacher came and said, you're picked, kid, you're playing on Friday. I thought, tremendous. I knew I'd break into the A team. Eventually, my goals have worked. This is going to be great. And then, of course, you learn that you're going to Stella Maris, which is the largest Catholic school in our neighbourhood. So we go down, and there is a little bit of tension. We play a match. We get beat 6-2. I scored, by the way. And it was a good game. But afterwards, it was what was left. For example, during the match when I got the ball, one of the parents on the sidelines tripped me up and called me an orange bastard. And I didn't even know what an orange bastard was. I had a fairly good idea something orange meant something about us. But I was only 14. I didn't fully understand the hatred. I was spat at and I was pushed. Can you imagine what happened after I scored? I didn't celebrate a lot, but I couldn't help myself. I might have done something naughty, I'm not sure, I can't remember, or I choose not to remember that part. But the abuse I got for the rest of the match was unbelievable. Afterwards, we got in the minibus to go back. And when we got in, the parents started banging the sides of the minibus. And they rocked it left and right. Now, there's only 11 boys, 14, sitting in a minibus going, they're going to kill us. Do you know what I mean? If these doors open, they're going to kill us. And for what? Because we Mitchell scored and did a funny thing. But let's be realistic. It wasn't all one way. When Stella Maris came to Rathcoole, what do you think happened to them? Well, I wasn't there, but I can imagine what happened to them. But we call that revenge. And this is where I think you get the problem. Were they taking revenge on us when I went for the first time? You see, it all becomes relative. Relative to me, the first time it happened to me, they did it to me. So if someone does it to them afterwards, I call that revenge. And you feel justified. But someone, somewhere along the line, somebody has to put their hand up and say, stop this. Revenge doesn't cut it.
Mitchell left school at 15 and after a period of long-term unemployment, managed to secure a position with the civil service. His family were very pleased.
Everybody was proud and everybody said, I told you the wee boy would be okay. He's doing well. And I went into the civil service and I knuckled down and I worked and worked and worked. That was until 9:05 on the first day. And I was in this horrible place, the compensation agency. A bomb would go off and we'd have 500 claims that day that all had to be dealt with. And my part in it was I opened the file and stamped a number on it.
A familiar division raised its head once more.
All my friends in the civil service were Catholics. My mates were Kieran and Damien. We went drinking together and I listened to these guys and I suddenly started to realise certain things about my own community. We were miles behind. These guys could sit and talk about the world. They could talk about politics. They could talk about their standing in the world. They could talk about Northern Ireland, the possible futures. They could put themselves into it. I just didn't have the words. I couldn't understand most of what they were saying, but I knew that they believed in something, and I knew that the more Catholics that I met, the more people that I associated with, I started to realise they were outgunning me at every opportunity. Every time they started talking about a united Ireland, my argument boiled down to this. That's a bad thing. Why? Because it is. And that's all I had. Do you know what I mean? They could go on for hours about why it's a good thing from their perspective. They would even go on for hours about why it's a good thing for me. So they were outgunning me there as well. And I thought, I'm not having this. I have to do something about this. And this is the steps that I took. Quite simply, where does it start? I can't talk properly. And I don't understand most of the words they're saying. I went, I bought a dictionary. I went and I bought a thesaurus. And I learned words, word after word after word. I read those books front to back, back to front. And I found that as I did, this process happened in my mind. I suddenly started to understand things that I didn't understand before. I suddenly found a voice.
Around this time, the future playwright joined a local amateur drama group as an actor, but he couldn't find material that would allow him to play a part close to his Rathcoole background. There was only one thing to be done.
It took me about a month to write a play called The World, the Flesh and the Devil. The lead character, Protestant working class man from Rathcoole, struggling to get the girl of his dreams. It was perfect. He's fighting against the world, he's fighting against the devil, and of course he's fighting against his own flesh. And I brought this play into the group and I said, guys, I've written the play, let's do it. We had a vote and they decided to do something else. At that time, and this is just one of those bizarre coincidences that we all need if we're going to be successful, BBC Radio Drama were running a competition and they had these leaflets scattered all over town in pubs and places like that. And it was very cheeky. It said, so you think you can write a play? Prove it. And I didn't want to get into a fist fight with a leaflet, but it did annoy me. And I thought, I can write a play and I will prove it. I took the leaflet home, filled out the details, and then I suddenly realised, hold on a second, I have a stage play. What the hell is a radio play? I have no idea. So I went to the library, went to the section radio plays, read a few pages from a few plays. And this is when the wee light bulb goes off in your head and you suddenly start to say, the difference between a stage play and a radio play cannot be simpler than this. You only write down what you hear. And what I did then over the next few weeks, I changed my play to a radio play. I took out everything that you can't hear and I left in everything that you could hear.
I'd been working in Belfast BBC Radio Drama Department, but not for very long.
Former BBC producer and director of Double Joint Theatre Company, Pam Brighton.
We ran a young playwrights competition. And one of the plays was, I think it was Gary's first play that came in. And I was absolutely knocked out by it. The heart of Gary's plays, I think, are always the same, which is how Protestant paramilitary organisations like the UDA particularly have preyed on Protestant communities, have preyed on the people who support them ideologically. So, I remember reading Gary's play and assuming that it was written by a nationalist or a Republican, you know, because I thought, who else could kind of lash into the kind of UDA like this? And then I met Gary, and of course he lived in Rathcoole. He was part and parcel of that kind of culture. And I thought it was quite extraordinary voice, certainly not one that I'd heard anymore, and a very, very important one. Gary won the Young Playwrights Award that year, and subsequently his play was produced for Radio 4 and got terrifically good reactions to it.
After a few radio plays, the desire was obviously still there, if not growing, to get something on stage. And I met a group called Tinderbox, and we decided that they would commission a play. That play was Independent Voice, and it was about a independent person, let's say, trying to break out of the Protestant mindset and trying to look back inside. These were people, if you like, trying to leave Rathcoole behind, but then trying to turn around and look at it and say, this is what you're like. This is where I've come from. This is where I am today. And then, of course, it gives you that idea that art can hold a mirror up to yourself, to your family and to your own community. And this is what these characters were doing. And I think that that was going along at the same time as I was actually having these thoughts myself.
Independent Voice was the story of a couple of fellows who decided they would set up a wee community newspaper in a large estate in Rathcoole.
Actor Dan Gordon.
Basically, they got an approach from a guy who said, "That's great, we'll support you, and by the way, we'll tell you what to write." And the two young fellas obviously get a bit uptight about this, and they decide that it's not a road they want to go down, and of course it has fairly bad consequences for them. One of the strangest occurrences when we toured the show was we took it down to a place called Kilcooley in Bangor, which is a well-known Protestant estate as well. And I played a character called Larry Simpson, who was the heavy. And a very particular type of heavy as well, the kind of guy who doesn't come in and shouts and rants and raves, but talks very quietly, and then will suddenly clear the mantelpiece of all the stuff and then say, "Now look what you made me do. I'm going to have to do that to you next if you don't do what I say." And that was very, very frightening. But when we went to Kilcooley, I look physically like a guy who had just been put in prison a few months previous, and they thought he was back. And it added an extra dimension to it, and you could have heard a pin drop when I was on. And I didn't know what had happened, and it was only afterwards they explained to me, "We thought you were such and such a guy."
I was commissioned by Point Fields to write a monologue. Now, at that time, this was just after I had written three episodes of a radio play about the police, about the RUC. At the beginning, when I first tried to get into the RUC to talk to people, they of course hit you with the publicity department. Whilst giving the appearance of being very open, they're actually a very closed door. What I needed to do, I realised very quickly, was get behind them and get into the reality. I started to get access to certain departments, detectives, different parts of the RUC. Then I started, of course, drinking with these guys. Now this is a tremendous thing, because this is when people really start to open up. But when I started to really get to know these guys and we opened up to each other, I started to realise there's a bunch of people here who are actually human beings. They have aspirations like me. And I thought, you know, as a writer, this is my job. To show the world that, you know, what you think isn't always the truth.
Alternative Future was a piece that was one monologue as part of four monologues. I think the whole title was Angels with Split Voices.
Actor Stuart Graham.
It was about a policeman who had decided that he wanted to be a stand-up comic. And the piece as it progressed, I think initially was very comic. However, as it progressed, it became increasingly obvious that it was more to do with his own psychological problems. That you know, and the comedy became more and more angry and more a much, much darker piece.
The overwhelming aspiration for me was to write a brilliant stage play. This was my number one goal. And still, to go back to the fact that the main character would be a Protestant, working class loyalist who we would love and quite possibly hate all at the same time, because these were the characters that I was so familiar with. And in many ways, it's what I felt about myself, and it's what I felt about the world. My family were quite mixed up with paramilitaries when I was young. That was before, of course, they became illegal organizations. This is when they were, if you like, legitimate community organizations who were trying to help everybody and just trying to stand up for the Protestant community. This is before they became criminal gangster organizations that most people don't support any longer. Certainly in the Protestant community, that's how they've degenerated. And I remembered, of course, that my uncle was the district commander of the UDA. He was quite a heavy, well-involved man, in and out of jail, various criminal activities, on the go at all times, but still seen within the community as a person that people respected, because he had this sort of soft side. So there was those two elements all sort of confused. So I sort of picked him and parts of my own dad, who was, you know, a sort of country and western singer, a guy who dabbled in this and that. Then I had my older brother, who was a Christian, a born-again Christian, and his girlfriend. And I sort of mixed them into it. And I started to say, right, I'll put this all in. I'm 100% confident about everything in this play. I brought that into Tinderbox, and they didn't want to do it, basically. I felt a bit hurt by that, given that we had sort of moderate success with the first play. But I did try then to take it to other people, and it seemed to be that there was a closed door to this. There was a suggestion that we've done a Protestant play. That's it done. Let's be honest, that encouraged me. And I thought, I'm going to go for this because, you know, you can keep on closing these doors, but I'm going to keep on opening them until this play gets done. And Stuart Graham was doing a play called Observe the Sons of Ulster by Frank McGuinness in the Abbey Theatre. And he said to me, do you mind if I take this play down and show it to somebody? Of course, I said, go ahead. I mean, here I am in what I believed was a Protestant country, and I couldn't get it on in a Protestant country. How am I going to get this play on in a Catholic country? Surely this is no chance. So go ahead, Stuart. Go ahead. You know what to do. Well, Stuart took the play down to the Abbey and gave it to a fellow called Christopher Fitzsimon. And within, I would say, 1 week to a fortnight, they phoned me up and they decided that they wanted to put this play on. I suppose that's where In a Little World of Our Own was the beginning of my relationship with the Republic of Ireland.
I directed Gary Mitchell's Little World of Our Own in 1997, which I now realise is 10 years ago.
Director Conall Morrison.
It had a remarkable feeling of authenticity, of a writer who knew intimately what he was writing about, but also had a superb story structure. It just moved along like a thriller, but not at a gratuitous way. The thriller energy captured the adrenaline of the situation, captured how fear, anger, sectarian energies can propel themselves at a ridiculous rate, and they don't leave time for thought, reflection, stepping back. So form and content seem to be perfectly allied. And I thought, I've got a bit of a winner here.
Well, after the initial success of In a Little World of Our Own in the Peacock Theatre, I was commissioned to do another play. I remember travelling down to Dublin to meet Patrick Mason, who ran the Abbey Theatre at the time, with Conall Morrison, who directed the original production of In a Little World of Our Own. The way that I pitched it was that it was a play examining and exploring the idea of loyalty within the loyalist community through various characters and their relationships. Not just loyalty to the organisation or to being British, but the loyalty to their best friend, to their wife, to their son, and that this is what the play was about. It took me 3 minutes and Patrick Mason said, we have to do this play.
Kyle, I think, actually says within the play, it talks about being loyal. And Freddie, that was the character played by Paddy O'Kane, is his best friend and has their lifelong friends that they're, you know, essentially joined at the hip. His wife, he believes he needs to be loyal to as well. His young family, he needs to be loyal to. And his community, he needs to be loyal to. And he is being told that within the loyalist family, he has to do certain things because those are the right things to do. Freddie doesn't quite see it that way. And Freddie decides that he wants to, you know, do his own thing, that in fact that the unionist community is going down the wrong road, and Freddie knows what the right road is, and he takes that road, which ultimately puts Kyle in a position where, you know, his loyalties become massively divided.
Well, I was writer in residence in the National Theatre of Great Britain, and I was very proud that it says outside the door, the National Theatre of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Very important to me was the trust that the audience invest in me. I think from the success of In a Little World of Our Own and As the Bee Sleeps, I think that my audience was increasing and that they trusted me to deliver my type of play. I started then this word trust going over and over and over. And when I was writer in residence, I thought how easy it is for the word trust to be blurred, and how trust is such a valuable commodity, but rarely given. So I suppose the word itself really resonated with me and influenced me so much that I decided this is actually a whole play. There's such a lack of trust in my community. You can't trust your brother, you can't trust your family, you can't trust your neighbour. And it extends from there. You can't trust the government, you can't trust the police, you can't trust a newspaper or a broadcaster. Who can you trust? That was the inspiration for the play Trust.
I played the character of Margaret, who is the wife of the, the local Rathcoole UDA Don Geordie, who was played by Patrick O'Kane.
Actress Lane McGaw played Margaret in Trust, produced at the Royal Court Theatre in March 1999.
Margaret and Geordie's 15-year-old son Jake is being bullied at school. Jake is a quiet child and, in, I think, to Geordie, an enigma, really. Margaret seems to feel very protective towards him, almost as though he's younger than he is. Geordie, for various reasons, is not prepared to step in and deal with this bullying, and it causes a great friction and conflict throughout the play between Margaret and Geordie, which really culminates in Margaret standing, pointing a gun at her husband's head.
Well, I think an awful lot of things changed in the year 2000. You know, I think that the focus of the world was really on change. And I think this applied to everybody, and everybody had these sort of thoughts, not just that it was the end of the world, but it was potentially the end of the Troubles, the end of all this nonsense in Northern Ireland. And I think out of that, I sort of expressed this desire to challenge again what seemed to be obvious or what seemed to be guaranteed. And I wrote a play called The Force of Change, again going back to my old police buddies and sort of trying to get a sense of the development there. What I felt was that, quite bizarrely, there was something more important in the RUC than Protestant and Catholic. There was something more important than loyalist, nationalist conflict. There was something incredible happening. There was a microcosm of the entire world right here for us to actually delve into. And this is what it was. It comes down to this. The Protestant and Catholic policemen were all drinking together and talking about the world through the same eyes, talking about the same problems. And what was their problem? The problem was that the world was unfair because it was biased towards women. And they quite simply came together unconditionally, unreservedly, to say the biggest problem in the RUC was that they were promoting women who couldn't do the job. And the amount of laughter when I suggested that, you know, that a woman could do equally as good a job as a man, the amount of laughter was deafening.
I played the part of Caroline Patterson in The Force of Change when it played at the Royal Court downstairs. Caroline has been fast-tracked in the RUC, and in my opinion, Caroline is a smart woman, and she has warmth. She has what a woman has, and what she brings to her job, I think, is important and good. However, the fact that she's been fast-tracked has caused resentment amongst several of her colleagues, and particularly the older policeman, Bill Byrne, who was played by Sean Caffrey, and the younger university type, very ambitious but quite misogynistic character, who was played by Stuart Graham.
After The Force of Change, Mitchell wrote Marching On and Loyal Women. But in late 2005, the writer's home was attacked and he and his family went into temporary hiding. Subsequently, a new play, Remnants of Fear, was performed in West Belfast as part of the Féile an Phobail. Mitchell has no intention of being intimidated into silence.
I think there's a danger that people can fall into this trap of, you know, post-conflict syndrome, which is to say that whenever somebody declares peace, the work's over. It's finished. You know, why do you need another Gary Mitchell play or another Gary Mitchell film banging on about the Protestant community now that everybody lives in peace and that it's all hands across the divide? Well, the simple reality is that that's not true. I think our history shows that every 50 years or every second generation, there's another war between the Catholics and the Protestants. So I think until 50 or 60 years goes by and we'd miss those wars, we can't really say that we live in peace or that the peace process has truly been successful. I think there has to be a determination that the work that we've all started to do has to continue. And more so, the fact that we've changed ever so slightly, it has to be, of course, applauded. We have to, in many ways, pat ourselves on the back and say, isn't it great? Ian Paisley, Martin McGuinness, blah, blah, blah. But we also have to say the danger is there. We can relapse into this in seconds, in milliseconds, if we don't continue to work against it.
The playwright in profile was Gary Mitchell. The contributors were Pam Brighton, Dan Gordon, Stuart Graham, Lane McGaw, and Connell Morrison. The programme was compiled and presented by Sean Rocks, and the producer was Kevin Reynolds.